19th. I am opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety, and I'm a public hearing on House Bill 2600. And we have invited testimony. It was last week, wasn't it? Jeez. The 12th, we had opened a public hearing on House Bill 2600 and was not able to complete it. And so today we're going to complete the hearing, and we will not do a work session on this bill today. So with that, I will call up Kara, is it Reich, of CASA from Benton County, and Heather Murphy and Scott Gallant. John, did you want to do an intro or do you want to do an intro? Sure. One moment. Go ahead, John.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, just to refresh your memories, House Bill 2600 transfers the CASA volunteer programs from the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, which is currently in the Oregon Housing and Community Service Department, to the Criminal Justice Commission. There is also a dash 4 amendment proposed that would transfer it to Department of Administrative Services. Just for context, using the current service level budget for the program, I understand the housing budget just went through subcommittee this afternoon, so these numbers would be updated per that if that was the way it went. But per current service level, the total budget of the program is $2,648,719, and that's general fund, and one position, one FTE, is dedicated to this program.
Whoever wants to speak
Madam,
first.
Madam Co-Chair, for the record, Scott Gallant, representing Oregon CASA Network. I'm going to speak very briefly and introduce the other panelists, Carrie Reek, who is the Executive Director of the Oregon CASA Network, as well as being the Director of Benton County CASA, and Heather Murphy, who is the Legislative Director of the Oregon CASA Network and Director of Lane County CASA. As LFO just mentioned, the Dash 4 amendments have been the result of numerous conversations among a lot of members, both of this committee as well as the legislature in general. We understand that there will have to be more refinement on the fiscal as we walk through this. It's our understanding that the Department of Administrative Services is willing to do its part, but it will obviously need adequate funding for the program. Carrie?
Good afternoon, Chair Winters and Chair Stark and committee members. As Scott said, I'm Heather Murphy, Director of Lane County CASA and a board member of the Oregon CASA Network. With me here today are Carrie Reek and Scott. I'm here to support House Bill 2600, proposing to move the administration of state funds from the Oregon Volunteer Commission to the Department of Administrative Services. We would like to thank Representatives Olson and Senator Johnson for their strong interest in CASA. They testified last week on our behalf. As you may know, CASA previously was housed with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. When that commission was abolished in 2012, most of its programs were moved to agencies with which there was an obvious fit. CASA did not have an obvious fit. There were many options explored and several potential conflicts of interest vetted before we landed temporarily with the Oregon Volunteer Commission. The Oregon Volunteers Commission is located in the Department of Housing and Community Services. CASA is a unique program with a unique set of volunteers that work within the child welfare and juvenile court systems. CASA's mission is to advocate for foster children who have been abused or neglected and help to get them into permanent homes safely, quickly, and effectively. We do that through ongoing programs. Program is in essentially every community in Oregon, local programs statewide that share the same mission. Local CASA programs in our state united just a few years ago through the Oregon CASA Network to speak with one voice to advocate for CASA programs in Oregon. and to provide cost efficiencies for training and education. Still, CASA remains locally oriented and locally operated. On behalf of my colleagues, I would like to state that CASA looks forward to a strong relationship with the Department of Administrative Services. We would like to be an active partner in designing a structure that would be successful within the department and help us to strengthen and build the capacity of the Oregon CASA network. CASA programs throughout Oregon and the Oregon CASA network support the proposed legislation to move the administration of state funds for our programs to the Department of Administrative Services. We appreciate the Oregon Volunteers Commission for taking on CASA when we needed a home. At this time, Oregon CASA Network respectfully requests the passage of House Bill 2600, effectively moving CASA July 1st. We strongly believe that a new partnership will allow us to thrive and, most importantly, to serve more and advocate for more vulnerable children in the care of the Oregon Child Welfare System. Thank you.
Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark and committee members, my name is Carrie Reek, and I'm the executive director for Oregon CASA Network, as well as Benton County executive director. We appreciate your time and your commitment in assisting CASA finding an appropriate home. And I know it's been a long session, and we really appreciate your continued commitment to this. As you're aware, CASA, we do recruit, train, and mentor and supervise community volunteers to advocate for children who are involved in the child welfare system. Our preference is to find a home with stability, collaboration, the development of strong support systems so that we can focus on serving more children in Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Director Katie Kobus here, because there's been a lot of the Dash 4 amendments, which would transfer CASA to DAS. So, Director, would you come forward, please?
Thank you. Good afternoon, members. Katie Koba, Chief Operating Officer for the State of Oregon and Director for the Department of Administrative Services. There have been a flurry of conversations around the amendments that would transfer the program to the Department of Administrative Services. And I can tell you that we are more than happy to do our part to strengthen CASA and make it a successful program. I am always one of those that puts on the record making sure we have clarity in terms of what is the role of the Department of Administrative Services, what is expected from the department, and the resources to go with that. And so I think we need to have a little bit more conversation in terms of the resource piece, what's coming from housing, the position, and the work that we're asking DAS to do, and how we're going to pay for that, because we don't have the existing resources to do that. So I'm more than happy to have those conversations.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is to have the CASA representatives meet with DAS and also housing, whoever is having the conversation, to clarify, and we can make that with a budget note as to what is expected of your role and what you're to provide, and then also provide us with what the fiscal would be. Would that be helpful?
Madam Chair, that would be very helpful. I have always found that things are successful when everyone clearly understands what the expectations are. And if we don't clearly understand, then we oftentimes get ourselves in trouble, and we're trying to avoid that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Questions or comments?
No, I support this plan because it's important to have clarity about this move.
Well, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing, and we will do a work session when and those documents and this comes forward with the budget note and clarity as to what the fiscal will be. So with that, John. And then I'll wait for the next analyst. Would you run and get out? waiting on paperwork to catch up. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3078. Colleagues, I just want to put a few things on the record before we start. LFO will review the components of the bill, but essentially House Bill 3078 is a product of a bipartisan approach to investing in public safety policy that is, and I like to call it smart on crime. There has been several hearings, policy hearings, that have been held with respect to 3078, and today it's invited testimony because I'd like to accomplish a couple things. One that wasn't a part of some of the policy discussions was, as I like to call it, we do most things as private-public partnerships in communities. So I wanted to hear from one of the individuals who actually has done a lot of work in Oregon with not only public safety policy, but also with our whole, I'm sure he was here with CASA as well, and that is Dick Withnail, who likes to fondly remind us of return on investment. The other is, as we work on fiscal implications, to actually hear from particularly community corrections, which will have the task of actually implementing the policy. And so with that, I would like to call Mr. Withnail up to share with us some of his comments. Oh, well, before you start, Dick, I've got to get my expert here to actually tell us about 3078.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, subcommittee members. House Bill 3078 does several things. It modifies eligibility for the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, increases short-term transitional leave from prison from 90 to 120 days, reduces the presumptive sentence for the crimes of theft one and ID theft, and allows for the supervising authority to impose high-level supervision for at least a year for those offenses. And finally, the measure requires the Criminal Justice Commission to study the impacts of the measure on prison utilization, recidivism, and public safety, and report to the legislature annually no later than February 1st.
And before you start, Mr. Withnail, I received an email via Representative Huffman that I know that he was requesting that this particular document was on OLIS. Did you get that accomplished?
It is, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So go ahead, yes. Mr. Withnail.
Well, Senator Winters, co-chair Stark, and fellow members, first of all, I just want to say thank you for serving. I really appreciate that. I do know a number of clinical psychologists that you want me to refer to you. But seriously, and also I want to point out, too, and I'll tell you very briefly, that Senator Winters and I have a conflict of interest. Her son has a Ford dealership, and I don't sell that product, but that's good. That's good. First of all, I'd like to say, and to be very serious, is on, just very briefly on the CASA. When I testified before you before, you may recall that when those two kids were in the Oregonian that came out of foster care.
Mr. Whitney. Withnell. We all know you, but would you say for the record who
I'm
you
sorry.
Are?
Dick Withnell, a business person here in Salem. Did an analysis of the $150 million that was paid out the last 5 years for Department of Human Services for suits against them. And we did the research, cost around $20,000 on each case, and not one of those cases had a CASA. Not one of those cases had a CASA. So I just wanted to say that. Well, thank you for allowing me to testify on this on the bill 3078. It seems like when we come to sentencing, it becomes very political. And I just I want you to know that I'm a law and order person. As a matter of fact, I voted for Barry Goldwater. He only won one state at the time in 64, I think it was. But seriously, though, I think there needs to be accountability in our society. And I got involved with the law and order issue with methamphetamine back in the early 2000s. There was a number of us that got involved, Brian Johnston, the late Brian Johnston, Judge Pamela Abernethy, and, of course, Senator Winters here in Marion County did. And we did make a change in the methamphetamine. But the unintended consequence came out was the foster care situation. What are we going to do with the kids? And then I just trying to build a case here of be advocating for this and that even though it is a very political issue and people say that you're soft on crime and all of that, I got involved with because of Fairbourse and because of Colin Peters or Colette Peters with the Measure 11 of young people going to McLaren. And over the 3 years, I worked with 35 kids up there and spent $63,009.43 on their education. Two of them graduated from college. You might recall that Sangdeo was released by Governor Kitzhoffer, and 23 of the kids had passed community college. What I'm trying to build the case for is what happens when we have smart, we are smart about changing a life. And what this bill to me points out to me is that we still have accountability, but we have a win-win here. We have a transfer of life, transformation of life, being productive, and we also have a return on investment. And I don't think that gets any better than that. I think sometimes when we talk about budgets and how we do with the different laws, that we're looking at covering expenses instead of purchasing results. And this is a case where whether it's CASA or whether it's having people being able to get the mental health and change their lives around with still accountability, this is really the way to go. And because they will be accountable. I think also that that all of us have our history, and I know that Senator Winters, I even brought a book of Ted. He's probably the best example, a lifer in our Department of Corrections, and he turned his life totally around, and he met a very sharp woman, Senator Winters, and I think that's what we can spend multiple dollars in sentencing, but if we can change that life. And particularly with the situation that we have now and there at 14,000 people incarcerated, with the Coffee Creek becoming bulging at the seams, and particularly if we look at the females who also have kids in Department of Human Services, what if we transform that life through mental health services? What if we get those kids back together in the family? We have really done something economically and also transferring a life. So. I'm sorry that Ken Thatcher couldn't be here here today to testify. Also, he as you recall, testified last time he was before you.
Are there any questions of Dick? I don't have a question. I have a comment. Those of us who live in not only my community but also statewide. Dick happens to be one of these individuals who have crisscrossed across this country, helping communities, whether it is CASAs, whether it is relief nurseries, whether it is getting community engagements to help them solve their problems, whether it is working and working with young people. When he talked about the $63,000, those 63 came from his own pocketbook. To help young people that are in McLaren go to college. So he and his family have been an individual that have, they don't, they talk it and they walk it. And he's fond of saying, big hat, no cattle. The other thing, but he's got a big hat and a lot of cattle. The other thing in this community, we know that when he got involved in the whole methamphetamine problem, he also did something else, because in this community we have what we call reentry. We do have, he's engaged the business community to become a lot more involved in these social issues that we tend to shy away from. And so I personally want to thank you and your family for all the work that you're doing on behalf of transformation of the lives of many.
Well, thank you, Senator. Of course, it's just not me. At the Casey Foundation last year gave us, we were 1 in 10 in the nation for addressing these problems, and it was a whole bunch of people, a lot more than just me. And I can remember getting a phone call from Mr. Frank when I had an opportunity to pay off the business that I had bought, and then Jerry Frank called me and he says, Dick, you didn't pay off your debt. And I said, well, yes, I did. And he says, no, the community did. And now it's time that you pay back your community. And boy, that's been ringing in my ears. And if you know Mr. Frank, it's Mr. Frank. it's living in this state, living in this community. What is our legacy going to be? And I think this is a real opportunity on this major 3078. I think this is an opportunity not to be soft on crime, not to be wishy-washy on accountability, but to really be able to transform a life. And I have a lot of conservative friends that say, you know, hey, wait a minute, we got to lock up people, throw the key away. Oh, that's baloney. And so I really would encourage you to consider a positive vote on this, because this will make sense, and we still haven't lost any accountability.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kiki Parker Rose. Jim Bernardo from Benton County.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, and members of the committee. My name is Kiki Parker Rose, and I'm appearing before you today as a Klamath County employee and on behalf of Klamath County and their Community Corrections Department.
And I just need to make one clarification, Clackamas County.
First, I'd like to thank you for providing me the opportunity to testify before you today. We are in favor of House Bill 3078 because it encompasses several key elements that strengthen our efforts to deliver effective supervision and services to those in the criminal justice system in our community. The proposed changes to the Family Sentencing Alternative Program, FSAP, proposed expansion of short-term transitional leave, STTL, and changes in sentence lengths for property offenders will enhance our ability to deliver an array of services to those under our supervision. In Klamath County, we operate a one-stop shop, which allows us to conduct risk and needs assessments and then target interventions and supervision strategies to address those needs, by using individualized case plans based on risk and need, and no longer taking the approach of the LICRA mentality, one size fits all. This assists us in targeting interventions that are more effective in changing criminal behavior. Klamath County has a high rate of foster care placement in our community. With our proposed FSAP changes, we are looking forward to a possible opportunity to become an FSAP county. We have strong relationships in our county, and I believe that this bill will allow us to keep families together, wrap services around them to assist them in being successful, and most importantly, end multi-generational criminality. Expanding our current service criteria will allow us to look for creative ways to intervene with families, not just based on their criminal record, but also their willingness to remain in the community to be part of their children's lives. This approach can allow us to work to reduce the number of women specifically sent to the institution and assist us with decreasing that population. We strongly support the expansion of STTL from 90 to 120 days. So far in Klamath County, we've been able to save 5,102 prison beds based on the 90-day expansion. We expect to increase that number significantly as it expands to 120 days. We have had 84 offenders released on short-term trans leave, with only 4 being returned to the institution. That's a 95% success rate. From reach-in to arrival at our office, we have services available to expand this program. Each person is assigned a mentor at intake. We have transitional housing available and on-site drug, alcohol, and mental health programs. We have education, employment, physical health services, on-site parenting, cognitive programming, peer support, as well as any number of services that a person may present with. Every criminogenic risk factor, those factors contributing to criminality, are able to be addressed at our facility. Our local community mental health provider, Klamath Basin Behavioral Health, is on site with us to help us with maximizing our investment in our community. Investing the prison bed savings into local communities is a cost-effective approach to enhancing offender success. I think it's important to note that nearly every person sent to prison will return to his or her community. Expanding STTL provides community corrections an opportunity to begin working with them early and moving them in a direction that makes them transition from prison to the community much smoother. Lastly, we support the changes to the proposed reduction in sentence length and number of prior convictions for property offenses. We should work together to continue to move Oregon forward in our work of making smart, data-driven decisions about whom we send to prison and how long they stay, saving our very expensive and valuable options for those offenders who pose the highest risk to our community members. Using and expanding risk-based sentencing will allow us opportunities to use our resources in a smart and economical manner. Investing in treatment is a win-win. Oregon is a model in the nation for our work in evidence-based practices. This bill continues to allow Oregon to move forward. Klamath County Community Corrections fully supports House Bill 3078. This bill expands opportunities for probation and parolees to be successful in their home communities. In addition, this bill will help invest limited resources where we can have the biggest impact. I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I am open to questions. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Senator Steiner, here.
If I could just make two quick comments, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank the people working on this bill for including the short-term transitional leave in this. I had another bill, Senate Bill 935, that did the same thing, so it's great to see it incorporated into one big package of really important public safety reforms that are focused, as the witnesses have said, on doing the things we know make sense, keeping people in their communities when it's appropriate. The other thing that I want to point out is we have Klamath Falls stepping up and saying this is important, Klamath County saying this is really important to our community. I have heard people say, well, it's only the big urban counties that benefit from changing short-term trans leave or can, manage it. That's simply not true. I've heard from other counties across the state. We're now hearing from Klamath County that they're doing this successfully. They welcome the expansion to 120 days. And I really appreciate your taking the time to come up here and testify on your successes with this program and how you're looking forward to expanding it, because it means a lot to me and all of us who are working hard to advance this important program forward. So thank you very, very much for coming. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're welcome. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably as good a place as any to get a comment on the record. As you know, I've mentioned in testimony, and because of what I submitted from partners on OLIS, I'm supportive of 3078, but I'm not supportive without concerns. Kiki mentioned community corrections, and so I thought, well, this is a great place to put this in. As you know, we just passed out the Department of Corrections budget where we took away $960,000 from community corrections for treatment and transitional services and support services. I'm a big believer in the funding for treatment and support services. I think that's the way these things work. And I'm also advocating to get the additional $12 million put back in justice reinvestment. So I've consistently seen us put money in and take it back away. And I'm not sure the position it's going to leave any of our community corrections. If we pass a bill and we don't fund it or underfund it or put in some funding and then take it away, there's not going to be a lot of good in that. So whoever is responsible for this and listening, I'm just getting my plug in there that I want to support this bill, but I'm going to have to see some stable funding behind it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're quite welcome. Just for the record, Kiki was also a part of the work that we did on 3194. And so it's to hear of the work that started in 3194 and to see what her work is on the ground and working with some of it and seeing what Klamath County is realizing. I think those statistics of saying that, they've had a 95% success rate tells a lot. That tells a story that we don't hear often in this building. But, and I'm also aware that, you've got a dedicated group of individuals down in Klamath. Thank you, Kiki. Who really worked hard on 3194, and I really appreciate all the effort that has gone in to making 3194 and those components successful. I do have a question. If we were to get 3078 and embodied in that is Senate Bill 416. And I know you're very much aware of 416 because we started that conversation back in 2011, I believe, somewhere back there in the Marion County, using Justice for Investment dollars, was able to use their dollars for that. Is Klamath interested in actually pursuing the work of Senate Bill 416?
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, we actually run a 416 program in Klamath County. It's called, we all have our own take on it. Ours is called KEBS, Klamath Evidence-Based Sentencing. It is mirrored after the Marion County program. We applied for and received a grant through the criminal justice system, through the Criminal Justice Commission and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. And we have the same grant that Lane County currently has. So we are using an evidence-based sentencing model 416 in Klamath County.
Thank you. What about the other part of that, the bookends on work release?
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, we are not running a work release facility. We previously did, but unfortunately in April of 2011, you may recall the state went through some tremendous budget cuts and we felt the repercussions of that and closed down our
kind of goes facility. To what my good representative just said. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. Co-chairs Winters, Stark, and members of the subcommittee, my name's Jim Bernard. I'm from one of those large suburban counties, Clackamas County. I'm the chair. Clackamas County is proud to have a community corrections program that leads other like programs in Oregon in providing services that support reentry of people back to our community after prison and jail. We do this by providing education, work training programs, as well as providing best practices, wraparound services when people leave the jail, including the ability to complete their GED. We actually walk them right out of the jail to our transition center. The result of the work is dramatic reduction in return of people back to prison and jail, and unsurprising results that by equipping these people, they are able to return to their communities with new skills and opportunities to be successful. Across the nation, community correction programs are providing that support service, not increasing penalties, reduce the changes, chances of low-level offenders recommitting the crimes that send them to prison. These efforts are good for individuals, good for communities, good for states' budgets, and good for county budgets. Perhaps most importantly, the result is a decrease in prison population and therefore a decrease in the need to build new prisons. Clackamas County is hopeful that, among other things, HB 3078 will expand Family Sentence Alternative Pilot Program in a way that allows Clackamas County to participate in the program. Additionally, we would strongly support a sufficient amount to be roughly $20 million in cost savings per biennium that would be realized by not opening a new women's prison to be provided to local justice reinvestment programs. These funds will allow us to greatly increase services that will help reduce prison population across Oregon. Clackamas County has experienced amazing outcomes as a result of the justice reinvestment strategies. But justice reinvestment has not focused like it should on women. I believe that addressing women's prison population, increasing reinvestment dollars, will strengthen our local communities and save scarce local dollars, and not only support reentry services, but also victim services. On behalf of Clackamas County, I urge you to support HB 3078 as amended. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. And I just want to mention a friend of mine, Dave Dahl, Dave's Killer Bread. Dave Dahl was in and out of prison many times until he had an opportunity to speak to somebody about his mental health issues and get the medication he needed. He would have remained there forever. And also the guitar helped. When he got out, he, with his brother, started Dave's Killer Bread in Milwaukee, where I was the mayor for many years. They hire people right out of prison, right out of jail, and have had a very successful program. And Dave credits the opportunity he had to find out, get the medication he needed to aid him in his mental health challenges. Life's not perfect for him. But I don't know if you know, they sold their business, and he's looking at other investments and continues to speak on behalf of the efforts that the county and the state has made to turn his life around.
Thank you. You mentioned that now we needed to actually focus on the women's population, and it reminded me of that when we were doing the work on 3194, we really did not address women specifically in that particular piece of legislation, and so now here we are a few years later finding that we didn't, and now we're having an issue of overcapacity of women in our at Coffee Creek. We're also, I think, as we begin to look at other issues, we're beginning to find in the foster care system and some of those other systems that actually interconnect, if you will, with the women in Coffee Creek, that we're finding a lot more that we need to do with respect to women and their children and their families. And so I think this session, we've actually have done a lot more, deeper dive into some of those issues. It has been very helpful to have Senator Steiner Haywood, who has DHS, that budget, and OHA budget to actually serve, on the public safety panel. And we've got a number, Representative Sanchez, who comes from the environment of working in communities, and also Representative Peluso, who's seen every walk of life coming in to her former career occupation. And then, of course, Co-Chair Stark and dealing with foster parents. So I think we're beginning really to do a much better look of connecting all these dots. And I think that really now then talks about, encompassing all these public policies that can help us strengthen the families, and in doing so, being able to provide some of those treatments. I share the concern of Representative Huffman that, whether it's mental health services or alcohol and drug treatment services, those services we must be able, and I know I envy often your county for the investment that you have made in housing.
Thank you.
And then I also have to say that I know that you took one of my people here from Marion County, that is your deputy there now for community corrections in Clackamas County. We train them and you take them, but that's okay.
Well, he's on the city council of Salem now.
Yes, we also have him on our city council. But honestly, these are the components that actually are some of the things that help to make this work. Yeah. And so that we do are able to lower recidivism and put families back together. And I want to thank both of you for the work that is being done in your respective counties.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think Nikki, did I see Nikki coming in?
She was here.
Is she here?
Nikki.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We've been deeply appreciative of what we've been able to do with the funds from Justice Reinvestment and the potential continued commitment for the coalition and our near 60 member programs around the state in each of your districts and also serving on reservation. There's two little blanks in this bill. We support this bill. There's two little blanks in this bill. One of those would be funds going into ODSVS. What we've been able to do with Justice Reinvestment dollars generally has been training co-located advocates so that we've got a domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking advocate working with the police departments, working with the court systems, working with the hospitals. Some of you were on a tour, and Co-Chair Winters, you know Jane Downing at the Center for Hope and Safety, an example of a program that has absolutely maximized these investments, and that is equaling lives. And that is equaling children staying in school, staying in homes, stability that grows with the child, and that I think is what's priceless. So this investment or potential investment coming through the bill is something that we would really look forward to and hope that you all can find a way to support.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike Schmidt.
Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I was not supposed to be here before you today. I was supposed to be in Boston right now. But I believe and am suspicious that the good Senator Winters may have called in a flight grounding. And I was not able to get out of the airport yet. So I'm here.
Senator Winters is powerful. I'm not sure she's quite that powerful, Mr. Schmidt, but, you know, there's a lot that I don't know about her, so maybe I'm wrong.
So today I'm here to talk about the methodology and the way that the Criminal Justice Commission staffed the speakers' work group on this that put together the report that came out of this and that I'll be referencing, but just in general to talk about how we got to some of these numbers. But I think what Senator Winters mentioned already, which is that when Justice Reinvestment 3194 passed, in the state, when we were looking at the way we forecasted the prison population, it was one big lump number, and it just was one line. Sometime after the passage of 3194, the Office of Economic Analysis split out that line into male and female. And that was really kind of a big aha moment, and we couldn't believe that that had already not been the practice. And what we realized that from the passage of 3194 was that, while our prison population was increasing and the conversation was around avoiding building Junction City, we had not, the members who looked at that and the people who worked on 3194 had not discreetly considered the women's population and their capacity at Coffee Creek and what that meant. Because if you look at the women's population just prior to passage of 3194, it's within 20 beds of being over capacity at Coffee Creek. I mean, we were already at capacity, but that wasn't part of the conversation. So since the passage of 3194, of course, the women's population in Coffee Creek has crested past their capacity number. And I think that provides a good backdrop of a lot of the conversations and some of the recommendations that come out of this bill. So starting with how CJC got to the analysis of short-term trans leave, it's one of the more straightforward analyses that we could do in terms of we know how many people are going to be in prison, and if you just expand from 90 to 120 days, that's 30 more days. So it's a pretty straightforward analysis for us to get the bed impact. There are a few assumptions, though, that we have to make in order to say what the expanded impact would be. One is that there's resources in the community that can provide for treatment and housing. Many of you, or probably all of you, know that part of short-term trans leave is that you have to have a place that is acceptable not only to the local community but to DOC and a plan for when you're released. So if there's no housing and there's no place for you to go and treatment dollars, then a county could and does reject a person coming out of short-term trans leave early, because they're not going to just release somebody under the bridge or to some place where they're not going to be successful. So resources is certainly one of the assumptions that our impact is based on, that there will be money for housing and treatment and those things, that people can continue to go into the communities even for a slightly longer period of time. The other assumption is that players in the sentencing will not plea out the 120 days, that they will abide the 120 days for people who are not being sentenced pursuant to mandatory minimum sentences, but that they will allow for 120 days. So that would be district attorneys and judges who are part of the plea negotiations and then the sentencing that would allow for the 120 days, and not, we would not see something that we haven't seen here to now, which would be in plea agreements that you are not eligible for short-term trans leave, or you are eligible up to 30 days, or you're eligible up to 90 days. With the passage of 3194 that expanded it from 30 to 90 days, I'm not aware of any county that has pled out short-term trans leave eligibility as a matter of practice. So that is an assumption that we make, that that will not happen with the expansion to 120 days. But it's an assumption that our fiscal impact rests upon for this piece of the bill.
Is part of that two things in the bill, this particular bill, it talks, the expansion is a may and not a shall, and a lot depends upon both DOC as well as the county. Actually, the county on the one hand saying, yes, that we will accept the individual, that we do have the resources in place before you can actually send somebody to that county.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, that is correct, and that is the way currently it operates with even the 90-day short-term trans leave. And so I bet you if you asked Director Jeremiah Stromberg if he was to say what the average short-term trans leave term is, it's some amount less than 90 days. It might be 87 days or so. But people are not getting 90 days automatically. They have to come up with those plans, and communities can deny people if they don't have the resources.
Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. Mike, kind of you were talking about the sensitivity with the pleading and so forth. And, you know, I sat through these work groups, and the majority of this bill I'm excited about: family sentencing alternative, expansion of 416, short-term trans leave expansion. And we've discussed on the Measure 57 portion. I want to make sure I'm understanding an assumption there. And if I'm not, please correct me. With the pleading issue, that if I remember in our conversations, the numbers on, by removing, you know, ID theft and theft one, that makes a difference primarily in the counties that are not currently really involved with, like, the 416 justice reinvestment type stuff. And so it seemed as though some of the DAs in those counties that were not really as eagerly involved in the justice reinvestment were, seemed to be some of the same DAs that were saying, well, we would just plead, or we wouldn't plead, we would just go ahead and sentence at the higher sentencing anyway. So is that accurate in your assumption? And if they do that, what sort of savings do we or do we not plan on?
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. I think that is accurate. I think that there will be some counties. We've seen varying levels of participation by counties and by certain district attorneys and certain local systems that have gone further than others. So I think we probably will see some specific counties that will not want to participate in the expansion of this program. We didn't, in the short-term trans leave numbers, work that in. We just assumed that the 90 days would be expanded to 120 days for all the counties across the state as they currently are. So that is one of the things that's underlying some of the risk in our impact projection.
Is that follow-up?
Follow-up.
And so is that the same thing with the Measure 57 sentencing, though, that if they choose to not play ball, then we wouldn't see those savings?
Yeah, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, that is correct. especially in property crimes, frequently, especially with the crime of identity theft, they come in multiple charges. And sometimes it's very not uncommon to see an identity theft case with at least 10 instances of separate victims, even, of identity theft, because possessing 10 different credit cards or 10 different checks or something would be 10 counts of identity theft. So when you have 10 counts, even lowering the sentence to 13 months of presumptive prison sentence, you can still very quickly add up to 26, which is 2 months over the statewide average sentence length for identity theft right now. So even lowering it to 13 months will have mitigated impact, and district attorneys that are not interested in lowering the sentence or local, I mean, and this also goes for judges as well in local systems. We've seen through justice reinvestment, there tends to be kind of a culture built around sentencing, even with defense attorneys, where you feel like a certain crime is worth a certain amount. And changing the sentence length, like we did in 3194 from 24 to 18 months, really had a minimal to almost no impact on identity theft specifically, which is why when you look at our fiscal, we did project that. We projected that the changes for identity theft would be much less than the changes for theft in the first degree. Theft in the first degree also frequently comes with multiple charges, but not to the extent that identity theft does. So we feel like there will be more of an impact. And we also base that based on when House Bill 3508 suspended Measure 57, we looked at how the counties reacted to those changes at that time, which would have put it back to a 13-month presumptive sentence. And so we modeled after that experience, where we did see a lesser impact for identity theft.
Can follow up? No. Can you help us then understand why, particularly, you know, Measure 57 was intended to actually punish the big-time drug dealers and what have you, and yet we're seeing a lot more women, which it's not the dealer, it's the property theft to feed one's alcohol and drug habits and what have you, and prostitution and what have you. Can you help me now understand in looking at that why, if that, you know, the DAs have the control of what's going on in sentencing, why we're seeing such an uptick in the number of women that are going into prison, I mean, over at Coffee Creek? There has to be something that's driving those numbers upward, even beyond, you know, because 3194, even though we didn't specifically call out women in when we did that work and didn't think that we had to, but now we're seeing more women that are going in. Is there any analysis that you've done to help us understand what's going on out there in the public safety DA world?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark. The short answer is to our analysis, no, there's no analysis that we've completed that would demonstrate why women are getting more filling up the prisons, except for that women are more likely to be in prison for a property crime than men are. 70% right now of the women in Coffee Creek are in there pursuant to a property crime. So whenever you raise the sentences of property and drug crimes,
you get more women.
You're going to end up impacting the women population more than you would commensurately with the men, who less of them are there percentage-wise for property crimes.
Senator Steiner, here we are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schmidt, of that 70%, do we have a guesstimate about what percentage of those are related to drug and alcohol misuse?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I don't have a guess. I mean, I would anecdotally, based on survey data and other things I've seen out of DSU, it's an extremely high percentage that drugs and alcohol are involved in the underlying criminality.
It was sort of a rhetorical question, to be honest with you, because I figured that was the answer. I mean, I think that's really, you know, I see Mr. Bowman nodding his head back there, too. So, sorry, I'm losing my voice. I mean, it's just, I'm asking it to point out that, you know, we don't really have a public safety problem. We have a drug and alcohol problem, and we have a mental health problem. And, I mean, I remember visiting Coffee Creek a few years ago, and Rhonda Stewart was the superintendent there at the time, and just saying to her, how many of these do you think could have been prevented? She said 90-95% of them, and I believe her. And I think, you know, getting people into the appropriate treatment not only makes more sense in terms of the long-term It's about keeping them out of prison and having them become productive citizens again, and hopefully helping them help others on that path so that we prevent the incarceration in the first place.
Any other? Reverend Sanchez.
She's looking everywhere but at me.
Reverend Sanchez.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. I just wanted to just sort of talk about that piece a little bit. So, to Representative Huffman's point and Senator Steiner Hayward, one of the things that, you know, I've been working in this area for a long time myself, and one of the things that we are starting to see a lot of is that a larger issue, as you mentioned, is the mental health pieces and the alcohol and drug pieces. But what we don't do is consistently fund and use innovative programming around those issues. We don't fund it long term. We don't fund the ability for people to stay in those programs long term. We don't fund the ability for them to keep their children in those programs. That is the piece that is really fundamental, in my opinion, to dealing with these issues. We are also setting situations up where we don't have the appropriate housing for people long-term and that's affordable. So people make choices about what they do in order to either stay in their housing, keep their children, and or deal with an issue some other way. Oftentimes, you know, people will, instead of dealing with their mental health issues, they will self-medicate. That is mm-hmm. an issue. That's what happens. It is such a struggle, I think, every single day for some folks to be able to just make it in the world, and they choose lots of different alternatives in order to handle that. Also want to mention, because we have to hit the floor here pretty soon, that one of the biggest struggles that I think I see for folks is that they're just, well, resource is a big issue. Resource is a big issue for a lot of people. But I want to just mention that it's what's hard in the world is when we don't actually support people to do better. And we have this larger system that we're recognizing to a degree that we're not able, I mean, we'll save money by not opening a prison. But we would save more money by supporting families, and rather than having people, anybody, women or men, go to prison, have their children go into child welfare, have their children then transfer into the OIA system, have their children then continue on into mental health and alcohol and drug treatment. Those, you know, there's so many pieces that the system touches from the very beginning of a child's life to where we are, where they are possibly going to prison, that we could mitigate and deal with rather than spending the millions and millions of dollars that we do on the prison system, which is why, of course, that I'm so very passionate about making this change and shift.
Okay. And I know you have to, the House has to go to the floor, but because of the broad range, and I know, you know, we were talking about the women's prison not opening, but I did ask the question of DOC because it's bothered me the more that we're hearing more and more about veterans, particularly those that are coming home, and how many of that population that we have in DOC. And I was surprised, under ID and property theft. Yes. And, you know, I was surprised we're talking 10% of that population. Yep. So it is, you know, when you start drilling in and you start asking the questions for this particular category, and we start looking at issues like the mental health issues and alcohol and drugs and some of those other issues, and what is getting individuals into our system, mm-hmm. and we know that the population, because it's all on our right now conversation with what's happening with our young men and women who are coming back from the war, and we call it conflict, whatever you want to call it, but it is battle. And so we know that we've set up veterans courts, we know that we've done drug courts, we know that we've done all these things, and I'm appreciative of the article that was posted by Representative Huffman. And it starts that America's prisons are failing. If they weren't, we wouldn't be here talking about how we're going to make this stuff work. Mm-hmm. And so I do appreciate all the work that's being done on talking about how can we get smarter in what we do in putting families and people back together. you know, and I'm mindful that DOC can't do it by themselves. You know, I think sometimes we often, as a society, think that if we send them over here, then we don't have to see it and deal with it anymore. And, you know, we've done a lot of that, and then we forget that 95% are coming home. And the question becomes, how many of them can we not have to send there in the first place, and how many of them in their coming home that we can make certain that we can provide them with what they need, and so that they can stay within the community and not have to go back into, or not go back into DOC. So I think that's part of the message of Smart on Crime. And so I thank you, Representative Huffman, for sending us that document and posting it. And with that, I know you have to get to the floor, and if there's no further business, we will work on the fiscal. I need to talk to Ms. Julie and others, and we are adjourned. Julie and others, and we are adjourned.